option.
Now, we're aware that you're all very tired, especially those of you who travel the long distance. But we will paint you a picture of what people have been doing to try to solve the important problem of quantum gravity here in Perimeter. And I will give the first half of the presentation, and Laurent will give the second half. We're not going to dwell on lists of people that you have literature about, but I want to emphasize that we're very excited about the people who are joining us. Bianca Dietrich, who joins us in January as a faculty member, and our new postdocs, Eugenio Bianca, Astrid Eichhorn, and Stefan Bielen. We welcome you here. We have a lot to be proud of, and I'll be trying to communicate, and Laurent will be trying to communicate, because reflecting over the last 10 years, and it is, just to personally mark, it's 10 years to the day since I arrived in Canada to be part of starting this institute. And what we think we have the right to be proud of in the field of quantum gravity is that we've created a school here, a school in the sense of a viewpoint, a school of research, a training ground. And we think it's fair to say that this has been one of the influential groups on the world scene, not by any means the only one, but one of the influential groups, both measured by the ideas, the importance of the ideas and the results which were found here and arrived at here, and by the people that we trained, the young people we trained, the postdocs and students who went forth with some of the philosophy we hope they gained here. A particular thing, again, it's not true only of our group, it's true also of Renata's group, but unlike some other groups, leading groups in this area, we emphasize the problem of quantum gravity and the whole array of viewpoints and tools aimed at solving it. We're not a place to push a particular point of view. We're a place to try to invent the right physics. I'll come back to that. A way to measure the influence, and this is something we're proud of, we only realized this yesterday with Laurent preparing this, is that a bit more than half of the junior faculty positions in this field the last 10 years were won by people who were former postdocs or PhD students in this group. It's a small field that's 18 positions over 10 years, but 10 of them were from this group. And I know we're not supposed to say group, but in that sense, maybe a better thing to say is school, because I think that what we are is a school of thought. Okay. Of those 10, 7 of them left us in the last 3 years. So the last 3 years has been an acceleration of activity, which is why this is a difficult presentation to give. In fact, the last 3 years in some aspects of what we do here has been an acceleration of the field internationally, as Laurent and I will be trying to communicate. The people in red are people who went on to faculty positions, and blue went on to postdoc positions. Okay. Now, everybody, the problem of quantum gravity, and I would say this also of the problem of quantum foundations, is everybody's concern in theoretical physics. These are, in my view, the two outstanding problems that we have to solve to really complete the business of the 20th century revolutions in physics. We have to understand how space-time, gravity, cosmology, and the quantum fit together. And because of that, we don't feel isolated here. We feel at the core with a lot of interactions with people in other areas with other viewpoints. Quantum foundations, there's a lot of interest, and Lucien didn't stress, I think, how much his own work and some of the other people's work in the field, in their field, is driven by thinking about quantum gravity. And some of our work in quantum gravity has the ambition of touching on quantum foundations. There's, as Daniel emphasized, and I don't have as good a graphic, but there is a key overlap which has been developed here and I think was initiated here of the overlap between quantum information and quantum gravity and broadening out to condensed matter and quantum gravity. There's a particular attitude towards ADS-CFT, which is a central idea in string theory, but not only, that has developed here from work of Laurent and some young people doing something called shape dynamics that we'll come to in a little bit, and so on. Cosmology is also a concern of ours. The particular philosophy of this school of thought, which again is not unique here, but to orient you to the description of the work that comes, is a hypothesis. Because this is about discovering what's true about nature, so we start with a hypothesis. The hypothesis is that classical space-time is emergent. Classical space-time is an illusion, to be provocative. The real physics is some background independent, which is a code word that means not formulated in terms of physical systems living in a space-time geometry, is some quantum system or some post-quantum system which doesn't know about space, doesn't know about geometry. If you're conservative and it's quantum mechanical, it's some quantum system, something like some generalized quantum spin system. And the hypothesis is that that's the real world, and space-time, gravity, particle physics, the standard model, quantum physics are all emergent from that. That's the hypothesis that our work is driven by. To study this, we need methods and we need models and theories to study. A thing to emphasize is that a lot of our work is technical and involves the development of techniques which are non-perturbative, because in our context, perturbation theory is very difficult to do because there isn't that classical space-time background which gives you a nice semi-classical state that you can do perturbation theory around. So a lot of the technical business of this field is developing non-perturbative techniques. Those are applied to models, and there are two kinds of models. And to orient you to what's coming, let me draw a distinction between these two kinds of models. There are fundamental models where you take a classical theory that you think has some right to be interesting, like general relativity or supergravity, and you apply a mechanism or a method of quantization to it. And that gives rise to a set of models. Some of them that are studied here are called spin-foam models, loop quantum gravity, causal dynamical triangulations, strings, etc. But sometimes, to focus on questions, technical questions, as well as conceptual questions of how this emergence of space-time happens particularly, there are purpose-built models, analogs of the Ising model in statistical physics, which are just built to study a particular issue or study the application of a particular technique. And it's important to distinguish between them when we're discussing different results. Okay. We use these different models to investigate big questions. Do space, geometry, and locality really emerge? That's the fundamental hypothesis from a quantum dynamical system. And if so, is the emergent space-time governed by Einstein equations to some approximation? A big question for physics and cosmology, are the classical singularities of general relativity replaced by dynamical events that you can evolve through so that Neo can have a cyclic cosmology? Just to make sure you're paying attention. And is time fundamental or emergent is another big question that gets approached from different points of view, technically and conceptually. And here's one that was, somebody sent us a photograph from a wall in Belfast, a piece of art. How can quantum gravity help explain the origin of the universe? Is one of our big questions. Now, famously, quantum gravity is an area divorced from experiment, and that's no longer true. There are some experimental questions, some phenomenological questions that do probe physics at the Planck scale, and here are four of them. Is parity broken in quantum gravity or not? There's increasing convergence on the idea that it may be, and it may be observable, particularly in parity-breaking effects in the CMB, temperature, B-mode correlations. Is Poincaré invariance broken or deformed? Is there evidence of a fundamental scale? Could you do a measurement that reads out the Planck length or the Planck mass? And are there non-local effects in quantum gravity? Since if space is emergent, locality is emergent, and therefore you would expect them to be disordered at some level, leading to non-local effects. So those are the kind of experimental anchors that are, and these all refer to experiments that there's actual data about, that are our anchors in the real world. Now, to talk a little bit more about what we do, and again, there's a lot of stuff to say, and we want to organize it for you all so that it's digestible. There are four major focus areas of work here at Perimeter related to these questions. The probably the most intensive is path integral methods of quantization, things that go under the names of spin-foam models, generalizations of matrix models, group field theory, causal dynamical triangulations. This is where the field as a whole has been moving. At the last Madrid meeting, which was the international meeting held every year in the field of quantum gravity, probably two-thirds of the talks were about different developments of path integral methods. There is still some work on Hamiltonian quantization, and being an old-fashioned guy, I'm one of the people who still wants to understand some things from a Hamiltonian point of view, and there are a few other people. There also has been growing here this overlap area of emergent quantum gravity using techniques from quantum information and condensed matter to study these purpose-built models to study emergence. And finally, the phenomenology that I was alluding to in those discussions of phenomenological problems, there have been important developments here of a phenomenological nature. And there are lots of other things because we have a broad group that I wish I had time but don't have time to talk about. Okay. Now, I want to emphasize that our governing philosophy is that we're not the X theory group. We don't think the right theory is on the table. Okay. Therefore, to make progress, we have to be inventive and creative and invent new models, theories, and hypotheses. And then, because we're physicists, so we want to eventually make contact with experiment, we have to study those models by detailed computations. And there's a tension and a creatively positive tension between those two tendencies, those two things. We have to do both. The last 3 years have been a very fertile time for the invention of new ideas, new models, and new hypotheses. And I'll just mention these, and then Laurent will be going into detail about several of them. New formulations of spin foam models, which Laurent will speak about and indeed was deeply involved with. A generalization of matrix models called colored group field theory, which allowed a lot of progress to be made on a certain kind of generalization of matrix models that have to do with path integral models of quantum gravity. Particular models of the emergence of space-time called quantum gravity. A whole new way of looking at the Einstein equations as closely related to conformal invariants called shape dynamics, which Tim Kozlowski and his friends did, and we're very proud of that because Tim is a postdoc and his two colleagues who were co-inventors of this idea were PhD students. And this is, we see as evidence of what can be done here. Relative locality, a really crazy idea that Laurent and I are co-conspirators in, an extension of special relativity that tells you that space-time doesn't really exist. There's something beyond space-time. And finally, some of us play with ideas about interpretations of quantum mechanics. And then to complement that, there have been major technical results. And I think at this point, I'll turn it over to Laurent. There are four of them that we listed here, and Laurent will be describing them.
Okay, so the first thing I want to emphasize or present, the first theme of research that has been developed here is about emergent gravity. So emergent gravity is a field which is a fast-growing field in the subject of quantum gravity, and it's also a field which is by essence interdisciplinary in the sense that it takes out some idea of quantum statistics together with quantum gravity. And the main question is essentially, is it possible to have a notion in which models in which gravity and quantum field theory coupled to gravity emerge in a system which is by essence purely statistical and mechanical in the beginning? And in this context, there are several questions to be asked. Is there some universality class of models that exhibit this behavior, emergent gravity behavior? And then how can you account for background independence when you have initially a model which is purely statistical and mechanical? This line of research has been developed mostly by Fotini Marcopulo and lots of postdocs and students here. And what she has focused on is trying to devise some kind of simplest model for this emergent type of statistical model, emergent gravity, and looking for what would be the Ising model for gravity. So she worked mostly on models that are defined on some kind of complete graph, where the linking of this graph is part of this statistical ensemble, and whether the link is on or off is a statistical variable, and then the matter lives at the node of the graph. In this kind of model, they are looking at the type of transition, whether there are phases that exhibit some geometrical behavior. Main results that they have obtained is essentially there's two types of results. In the classical models, they have shown that it's possible to obtain a low temperature phase where geometry emerge, where you have a network which has only local interaction and very few non-local interactions, and then you can understand this network as a discretization of some kind of geometry. And then in quantum models, they have shown also that in one phase, it is possible to have matters of degrees of freedom that propagate in a curved geometry, and also that there's a general bound called the Lie-Robertson bound that shows that there is a maximum speed of propagation. And this has led to several developments that, they are currently developing here. Another major theme of development in the field, yes?
Is there dynamical space-time in this continuum limits, or it's just a fixed space-time?
At this level,
Alyosha, I think.
Yeah, it's dynamical. Yes, it's dynamical. So what we really have is a Bose-Hubbard model. So in the Bose-Hubbard model, you have the particles hopping on a graph.
Yes.
But here the graph itself is made of a bunch of quantum degrees of freedom, so it's evolving according to the direction of the particles.
So there are spin two gravitons that propagate in the continuum limit?
So we deal with the continuum limit. So this is a lattice theory.
Yes.
And it only
mimics the large scale.
No, they're not spin two gravitons. So it doesn't do very much, but what it does is that it is a many body system in which the graph is not fixed. So you have a post-hubbard model in which the graph is evolving, and it mimics this fact that the space tells the matter where to go, and the particles tell the space how to change. And we are not saying that they change in a way that is consistent with general relativity. This is just the first example in which the two things interact like this, but in a very simple lattice model.
Yeah. I think what you're referring to is one of the challenges, the question was how background independence, in some sense, can emerge for some model. And this is still one of the main open problems. So the next theme of research that has been developed here, the goal of this research, so it goes under the name of spin-form models, which essentially provide a path integral quantization of gravity with the particular property that the boundary states are labeled by spin network states, which are graph labeled by a group representation. So the goal of this set of research is really to be able to define non-perturbatively a quantum gravity dynamics, and more precisely focusing on the definition of the quantum gravity amplitude. So this has been a field that has has been here for a long while, and this model has been studied extensively since the 90s, but they remained key challenges. Essentially, the main two key challenges that were open are the notion of the semiclassical limit, and then the notion of the continuum limit. So the semiclassical limit is that essentially you want to build up such models, but you want to be sure that the dynamics that you recover in the classical limit is the dynamic of general relativity. That's the first requirement. And then the second one is that these models are intrinsically kind of discrete. So you want to have a procedure in which this discreteness is somehow washed out or erased or enriched the continuum limit. What happened in the past 3 years is that on both of these fronts, there has been major development in the field. And what I want to advertise is that you can trace both this major development work that has happened at PI. So the first work is that is a work done with Kirill Krasnov, who was a visitor, a long-term visitor at the time. It's a work in which a new spinform model was proposed, which resolved many of the technical challenges that were out there at the moment. And this model has been since then the basis of dramatic and, you know, tremendous development and progress. And essentially, one of the main results is the proof that this model possess the right semi-classical limit and converge to the Dirichlet action. There has been work by other groups that you know, leads to correct gravitational propagator. And this is the source of many recent development which has to do with understanding the property of these discrete geometries and their symmetry property and the link with Twister theory, which is a surprising link there. To emphasize the fact that this paper has been influential, it's that this paper is the most cited paper in quantum gravity of the past 4 or 5 years. The next work has to do with the solving the continuum limits. I'm trying to address the problem of the continuum limits. And in this context, one way to do that is, once you define this spinform amplitude, you like to be able, one way to deal with the continuum limit is to have a way to be able to sum over these different spinform amplitudes all together and make sense of this summation in a convergent manner. And what happened is that it was known for a long time that there's auxiliary models you can devise that are called group fit theory models or tensor models, which are essentially doing that. That is, they are resumming this spinform model. What happens is that the Feynman diagrams of these models, so these models are kind of generalized fit theory or degeneralizing matrix model, and their property is that their Feynman expansion are dual to triangulation of dimension 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. And the perturbative expansion of these models represent a summation over spinform amplitude. So here's the diagram, like matrix models carry only two legs, and when you can associate to matrix model some kind of little pieces of two-dimensional surface. And when you glue them together, you know, and sum over them, you can interpret this summation as a summation over surfaces. So the tensor model are generalization of that, where now you have objects which have higher, instead of two, you have higher number of indices. So it's, you know, and these models in some sense sum over all possible topology. And it's notoriously, I mean, it's well known that it's extremely difficult to make sense of sum over topology. So in this context, the question is, can we make sense of this group fit theory model? Are they renormalizable in some sense? And this is what the recent work done at PI is addressing. And it opens the way towards the theory of renormalization of this group fit theory model. In some sense, this line of research was started in 2009 with two postdocs here. And it's a technical result that has to do with some kind of understanding the convergence property of a class of graph. But this has led essentially the next development were done mostly by Razvan Goro, postdoc, 5-year postdoc here, and collaborators. And essentially what he did is first introduce a simplified version of this group theory. But the major result has been the proof that this model admits a 1 over n expansion and the large n limit exists. So when I say that it's notoriously difficult to sum over topology, there's one case where it was known. It's in 2-dimension, because in 2-dimension, you can organize the sum of a topology as a sum of a different genus of Riemann surfaces. And then it was also known that the sum of a genus of Riemann surfaces arise naturally when you do an expansion of matrix model where the size of the matrices are large, which is this large n limit. So the idea there was to extend this property to a higher dimension. And the idea maybe have been there for a long time, but, you know, finding a realization of it was very difficult. And this is what happened here. And there is, you know, lots of activity which have been going on recently and is undergoing right now, which has to do with really understanding the critical behavior of this model that now resum this quantum gravity amplitude. The next thing I want to talk about is what we call the principle of relative locality, which is a new extension of the relativity in principle, leading to a general framework enabling us to deal with systematic observation of quantum gravity. And in fact, this formalism encompasses most of the previous work done in this subject in the past 10 years. So it gives a general theoretical framework and a precise way of doing computation there. Development addressed two key questions. The first question is, what kind of phenomenological consequence of quantum gravity can we expect? It's well known, a priori, it's very difficult to test quantum gravity. And so this is one question that we have to face if you're working quantum gravity. Is it possible in any manner to test quantum gravity? The second question is more theoretical, but even if we don't agree on what is the theory of quantum gravity, every worker in quantum gravity agree that a fundamental feature of quantum gravity is that it's a non-local theory. It contains some kind of inherent non-locality. So how can we deal with this inherent non-locality of any theory of quantum gravity? And the approach here is to take that we have the idea that we have developed is to try to take a bottom-up approach where we somehow try to deal with the problem of non-locality arising from quantum gravity in a controllable manner. And what we do is that we look at a limit some kind of classical limit of GR, which is the following limit, defined by the following approximation. We work in the limit where both G Newton and H bar ascend to zero, but their ratio, which is the Planck mass, is fixed to a constant value. And we want to study the limit of quantum gravity in this regime. So in this regime, what happens is that instead of looking at the physics in terms of space-time observable, we have to look at physics in terms of energy momentum space type of observable. Now, in this limit, there is an energy scale, which is the Planck mass that arises, and it is shown that this energy scale sets up the scale for non-linearity arising in energy and momentum space. And the next step is to show that, in fact, these non-linearities momentum space, once you postulate them, can be elegantly coded by curving the geometry in momentum space. So they can be given a geometrical interpretation. And then the result is that there are striking consequences which have to do with the fact that this theory violates the locality as we know it. And these consequences are constrained by experiments. So the mantra of this field is that space-time is no longer an invariant concept. Space-time is energy and observer-dependent. Okay. So to give you an idea of the type of limit, imagine that here we are dealing with quantum gravity. And instead of parameterizing the deformation space of quantum gravity from special relativity in terms of G Newton and H bar, we use G Newton and the Planck mass. So now we can take different limits. We can take the limit where the Planck mass goes to zero, and in this limit what we recover is general relativity, Einstein theory of gravity, where space is curved, but momentum space, the notion of energy is like the notion of velocity, has some kind of linear structure. And in this context, it's well known that there's no invariant notion of energy. What we're interested in our concept, in our context, what?
P and okay. Yes.
Sorry. What we're interested here is the other limits where we take G Newton goes to zero. And what happens is that instead of having a phase space associated with excitation, which is the quotangent ball of a curve manifold, now we have a curve momentum space. And in this context, space-time is no longer an invariant. It's energy and observer dependent. Let me give you, so in a nutshell, the geometry of momentum space, how does that arrive? The non-linearity of momentum space can enter in two ways. They enter either via metric, and essentially the metric measures the modification of the energy momentum dispersion relation, or they enter in terms of a connection of momentum space, and the connection encodes the modification of the law of addition of momenta. The demand that the metric and connection of momentum space are flat is equivalent to assuming absolute locality, that is, the existence of an invariant space-time. Now, in this context, once you have the geometry, there's three types of tensor that arise, non-metricity, torsion, curvature, that leads to different type of phenomenology. And they all lead to surprising and measurable non-local effect, because if one of them is not zero, then locality is broken, is not there. And we have looked, for instance, at propagations of photons, the different energy produced by distant gamma rays. And we can find that there is, you know, bound on the non-metricity tensor and very weak bound on the torsion tensor. But the main message is that quantum gravity effects of first order in energy of a Planck mass are constrained in this framework by... Yes, so the non-metricity and torsion, the first effect would be energy of a Planck mass. Curvature would be energy square of Planck mass square.
So that's why you do better from the gamma ray burst than TeV.
Yeah.
Because usually these constraints come from the higher energy photons.
Yeah. I mean,
they're TeV lasers. Yeah. But we can look at an arrival event, TeV photons rather than GeV photons. Friendly's looking at GeV photons. So usually if it's going as momentum squared, you'd be better with TeV events.
Yeah, but usually you have to see the whole burst. So if you just get a few photons from an object, you can't do it.
If I could just comment, the claim of a few years ago by Ellis and collaborators to have seen a delay in TeV photons, or I think Marconian 501, cannot be true if the result of Fermi in 2009 is true, but we use the Euclidean limit, that is true. So there was a frisson excitement about
it. There's an excitement about it, but then there's been a lot more data recently on these TeV systems. Right?
Okay.
The sensitivity to TeV has been improving pretty rapidly.
One type of experiment I'm also excited about, I don't know, it's not yet, I don't know, we're really very conjectural, but it's some type of tabletop experiment. In some sense, what we're saying is that if you take a quantum system, and we're discussing with a group in Vienna about that, but if you take a quantum system and you make a loop in phase space, locality is essentially the assumption that the property of this system, of this loop, depends only on its projection onto a space-time. And it's totally dependent on the shape of this loop in momentum space. So, you know, now you can imagine, you know, trying to, you know, kick a system, make a look in phase space, and try to see how much that is true or not. Okay, and then the last thing I wanted to mention very rapidly is shape dynamics developed by postdocs and several students here. And essentially, it's a new theory equivalent to general relativity or, you know, gravity, which has surprising property. The main surprising property is that it has a property of being locally scale invariant. It also possesses a preferred slicing of space time. Mm-hmm. And this goes under the name of shape dynamics. It provides a nice reformulation, in some sense, of CFT gravity correspondence, and opens the way towards maybe, you know, new way to look at the quantization. And I wanted to emphasize as Lee that this was developed, you know, by the postdoc and PhD student first, and has been already the subject of a special session at the Loop conference. Thank you.
Questions? I have a question. Mm-hmm. Is there a toy system? I don't even know what you mean by emergent time. But is there a toy system which one can solve exactly that illustrates emergent time?
Yes, but you shouldn't take it very seriously.
What is it?
Consider people do things like consider two harmonic oscillators coupled together, different frequencies with a small coupling, and consider the zero energy, consider an energy eigenstate. An energy eigenstate doesn't evolve in time, and there is a notion of, quote, timelessness, roughly analogous to what people claim about Hamiltonian constraint, the solution of the Hamiltonian constraint being timeless. But you can imagine looking at a relational observer, which is the position of, say, the momentum of one oscillator as a function of the position of the other oscillator. And you could discover that there is oscillations in the system by looking at operators which are commutable to Hamiltonian, which measure correlation between one to be a figure of one provide us and the other to be a figure of another. This is just the old story with the river Wood equation, and you solve that in the
yes.
extension.
Yeah. I don't buy the whole, speaking personally, I don't buy the whole thing, the whole ideology at all. It's one of these things which you can exhibit with the little toy system, but then you go on to what would have to be true for this to arise from the
theory.
Theory.
So you ask, you now define the structure of what you mean by time, and then you look for that to arise in which.
Yes.
Go.
And roughly speaking, what you need to do this in general relativity is construct constants of the motion, which are exact, which is asking a lot, because general relativity is not known to be known with the system, which have the interpretation of giving the correlation of some degree of freedom with another degree of freedom in the all of time.
There is, I think, a general version of this, which is John Briggs and his colleagues. I suspect the idea has occurred to a number of people, where you derive the time-dependent Schrödinger equation for part of a system from the time-independent Schrödinger equation for a whole system.
It
sounds rather similar.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think. Maybe just in terms of the model, the relative probability model,
mm-hmm.
you mentioned experimental constraints, which I didn't fully understand because you're putting N Planck in as a natural scale.
Yes, yes. So, yeah.
So, where are the constraints?
So a priori, you know, if you assume nonlinearity in momentum space, so there's no need for, you need an energy scale that says of the scale which nonlinearity are visible. So, okay, we assume this scale is, if you assume this scale is a Planck max, then what we have is that this geometrical feature that will arise, like the torsion or the non-metricity, will have, you know, will be always of the order energy divided by Planck. To some power. So this is really where this scale enters, and the bound we have put is for the effects that would be linear in this energy or n Planck deformation.
But you know, like how to measure momentum space torsion.
Yes, that's the thing. The thing is that you assume that, let's say, momentum space has torsion. Then what we say is that when you look at distant photon, you're going to have some kind of dual gravitational lensing effect. Photon of different energy, even if they come from the same source, we look like they come from different points. So, you know, you're going to get, for instance, pixels. You know, if the scale was very large, then you would get a pixelization. Or if non-metricity would be present, then the effect you would get is that distant photon emitted at the same time would be received at different time here. So effectively, we look like we have energy dependent speed of light. Now, curvature is a bit more complicated, but I can also describe. So what you do is that you assume, some geometrical feature which essentially assume non-locality, and then you see how you would witness that, and you put bound on that part. Is that of effect?
The current bounds, observational bounds, are in no way
in no, so far, no. So far, no.
Maybe the best way to say the best bound of the things we've looked at comes from the possibility of a time delay in gamma ray bursts, the bound from Fermi. And so you can write that bound as a bound on the components of the non-metricity tensor. So the non-metricity tensor, which has dimensions of 1 over energy, has to be less than 1.6 times 1 over the Planck mass from experiment.
It's the same thing. Imagine that, you know, you do with gravity. If, let's say, if space-time is curved, then you see certain effect, and you go look for it, and that's how you put down on the curvature of space-time. So here, we do the same thing. The thing is that Planck mass is very big, right? So it's very hard to see effects. That's the problem of quantum gravity. But now, here, on the other end, what we're dealing with is we're departing from the usual hypothesis of theory, which is locality. So therefore, the effects we're predicting are extremely surprising and new and counterintuitive. So that's where, in some sense, you're gaining an extra visibility factor.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't, and also we haven't really looked systematically at this effect. And when I was talking about designing tabletop experiments, for instance, you know, people, we assume locality. In every physics you do so far, you don't even think about it. Of course you think space-time exists and it's universal, it's the same for everybody, and it exists forever, so you don't even question it. So therefore, yeah, you don't look for it. So here, what we want to do is set up a framework where at least you can ask the question, what if, you know, this assumption, I mean, the framework where you can question this assumption, the assumption of locality, instead of just assuming it without, you know, knowing that you're making this assumption.
With
the
sensation, you could devise a tabletop experiment.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tabletop experiment that will detect this mass scale, yeah, if it was a tag, for instance, first. And then, you know, whether this tabletop experiment will reach Planck scale sensitivity, that's, I think, you know, it's as a two-step process, right? Like, you know, if this scale of Planck mass was way larger, what kind of non-locality effect would you predict?
I mean, just to give an example, here's an experiment to talk about interferometry in phase space. But you take a beam of photons, you go through a doubler, a frequency doubler, you split, and they both travel, and then you take the one that was not doubled and you double it again. And then you compare, then you have two ways that a photon can arrive at an interferometer with twice the original frequency, one of which traveled a long time at twice the original frequency, and one of which traveled a long time at the original frequency and was recently doubled. And that makes a closed loop in phase space, and you can work as a function of the frequency and as a function of the distance of the propagation for a phase shift effect. So it's doing interferometry in phase space. So this is an effect that normal physics would predict would give a null effect. It shouldn't matter which one you take. There may not be a tabletop version of this that gets Planck scale sensitivity, but even conceptually the idea is interesting. And maybe with something like LISA, you know, propagating photons over astronomical distances, one could do something that would have interesting sensitivity. So a new idea suggests new experiments, and that's that at least fascinates us.
Maybe I should just mention, in this connection, most of these effects that have been talked about are at least looked at naively Lorentz invariance violating effects. But there's another class of possible effects.
Sorry, let me just interrupt.
Okay.
Naively, yes, but in the context we're working in, no. That is, all these effects exist in the context of a full 10-parameter symmetry group, which is a symmetry group on momentum space. But it might be that the symmetry group of momentum space is an anti-de Sitter or de Sitter symmetry. Nonetheless, okay, so this is not equivalent to disagreeing with the Lorentz invariance.
That's why I said naively.
Okay. Anyway, please go ahead.
But there's another class of possible effects that are completely consistent with Lorentz invariance that you might imagine tracing to an underlying spatiotemporal discreteness, which many people think is there. And just as the discreteness of atoms gives rise to Brownian motion, some sort of fluctuation, you might expect that the discreteness of space-time gives rise to comparable fluctuations in the propagation of particles or of photons. And it turns out that the Lorentz invariance is such a strong constraint that in the particle case you have essentially a unique description of this Lorentz invariant kind of diffusion with only one free parameter. In the photon case you get another free parameter which has to do with the diffusion and frequency. Again, there's no theory of these, it's just a suggestion that they could be there. You can make some sort of ad hoc models using causal sets that suggest it. But it's another thing where so far you just have very strong constraints from observation on the magnitude of the associated diffusion constant. The CMB turns out, the fact that the CMB is so perfectly Planckian turns out to produce a very strong constraint on the parameter, something like 10 to the minus 96 in Planckian.
There's a Lorentz-invariant model of diffusion and frequency in Frenchman?
Yes, surprisingly enough. Yeah.
How do you do that?
Perhaps it's easier to see. Well, I mean,
isn't there always a characteristic time which isn't defined?
There is, but surprisingly enough. So you might think that along a photon world line, the proper time is zero, so how could there be any diffusion? That's a very good question, right? But it turns out that there's an answer, which is that the photon wave number or frequency, together with the proper, coordinate time, gives rise to an invariant, which has the meaning of a kind of area. I could show you a diagram. But there is an invariant parameter with respect to which the diffusion could take place.
And just if we live a billion heartbeats, a photon after a billion oscillations changes its frequency.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Other questions from the audience? Anyone in the audience? Cool. Okay. It's time for the committee to go hide somewhere and talk about what we're doing. So thank you guys very much.